Welcome to the Veritas Forum, engaging university students and faculty in discussions about life's hardest questions and the relevance of Jesus Christ to all of life. For more information about the Veritas Forum, including additional recordings and a calendar of upcoming events, please visit our website at www.veritas.org. The following material is copyrighted and may not be duplicated, reproduced, or redistributed without prior written consent from the Veritas Forum. Join us as we explore true life.
Well, let me say first, it's a pleasure to be here. I've never had the chance to be on this campus before, and I'm really glad to have the chance. And I hope everybody's got a copy of this handout, which will make things go somewhat more smoothly, I think, if you do. Okay, well, the title of this talk is An Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism. And by naturalism, I'm thinking of the sort of view, there's some examples of people in the second little paragraph who are naturalists, as I'm thinking of it. Carl Sagan, Stephen Gould, David Armstrong, the later Darwin, John Dewey, Bertrand Russell. A recent book by Daniel Dennett is a really good setting forth explanation of naturalism. It's called Darwin's Dangerous Idea. I don't know if any of you have seen this book or not, but I think people probably will be taking a look at that book. So the naturalist, to think about, it's not that easy to say precisely what naturalism is. I mean, lots and lots of people claim they are naturalists, and it's supposed to be a good thing, but beyond that, it's not exactly clear what naturalism amounts to. I think the way to understand naturalism, the fundamental way, is to think of it by way of contrast with theism, according to which there is a person, God, very powerful, very knowledgeable, very good, who has created all of us human beings together with the rest of the world, and we human beings resemble him in that like him, we've been created in his image, and like him, we have knowledge, we have aims and intentions that we can act to try to fulfill, and the like of that. So on the theistic picture, there is God on the one hand, and God's creation on the other. If you expunge God from the picture, you might say, then the resulting picture is the picture of naturalism. It's not exactly right, but it's fairly close. All right? Now, that's one sort of focus of this argument. It's really got two, so I guess my argument, if not circular, is at least elliptical, because it's got two foci like an ellipse. The other focus of the argument is evolution. And here I'm thinking of evolution in just the ordinary way, the way in which we learn about it in college courses on the subject, as an account of how it is that there is this enormous variety of living things that the world displays at the present time. Evolution and naturalism are often thought of as allies in a certain way, or perhaps evolution is thought of as a kind of pillar, you might say, in the temple of naturalism. But I want to argue that they are, at best, uneasy bedfellows, and that, in fact, their conjunction, believing their conjunction, is, in a certain way that I'll try to explain, irrational, contrary to reason. All right, so that's what I want to argue. That's my thesis, and that's why I call this an evolutionary argument against naturalism. All right? Okay. And this argument focuses, the argument I want to give focuses on some implications of that conjunction, the conjunction of evolution with naturalism, focuses on some implications of that for our cognitive faculties, for the things, for our beliefs, and for the faculties that produce those beliefs. Those are the powers or faculties or capacities whereby we have knowledge or form opinions, form belief. And examples would be memory, of course, and perception. Those would be among the sort of most popular faculties, cognitive faculties. Memory, perception, reason, maybe others. Maybe there is Thomas Reed's sympathy, whereby one knows what others are thinking. Thomas Reed's testimony. One learns a lot of things by way of learning them from other people. And still others, John Calvin suggests the sensus divinitatis, that's another cognitive faculty, and so on. So there are several different cognitive faculties, and the argument I want to give focuses on the relationship between evolution and naturalism on the one hand, and The question whether or not our cognitive faculties are reliable, on the other hand. All right, that's what it's all about. From a theistic point of view, I mean, the idea that our, the sort of normal idea we've all got that our cognitive faculties, at least when they're functioning properly, are reliable, fits in really well with theism. The idea in theism is that God has created human beings in his, in God's image. So we resemble him in various ways, and in particular resemble him by way of knowledge, by way of being able to achieve knowledge, by way of having understanding. Thomas Aquinas expresses that sentiment in the next couple of little paragraphs there. He says, "Since human beings are said to be in the image of God, in virtue of their having a nature that includes an intellect," that's what it is. That's what it is that makes them be in the image of God. "Such a nature is most in the image of God," that is, a nature that includes an intellect, "in virtue of being most able to imitate God." And he also says, in the same general neighborhood, "Only in rational creatures, creatures with ratio or with reason, is there found the likeness of God which counts as an image. As far as the likeness of the divine nature is concerned, rational creatures seem somehow to attain a representation of that type in virtue of imitating God, not only in this, that he is and lives, and we also are and live, but especially in this, that he understands, and so do we." Now, of course, you can't sensibly argue, a theist can't sensibly argue for the rationality or for the reliability of his or her cognitive faculties by taking as a premise that we've been created in God's image. To give an argument is already to take for granted that one's cognitive faculties are reliable. Because, of course, if you thought they weren't, you couldn't trust the argument. You couldn't trust the premises. You'd have no reason to think they were really so if you don't think your faculties are reliable. Nor would you have any reason to trust your inclination to think that the relation between premise and conclusion was such that, given the truth of the premises, the conclusion would have to be true, too. All right? So you can't argue from the one to the other, but they sort of naturally fit together. And now the next little paragraph there. Most of us think, or would think anyway on reflection, that at least one function or purpose of our cognitive faculties is to provide us with true beliefs. What is the heart for? To pump blood, to circulate the blood. What are our cognitive faculties for? To provide us with true beliefs. Moreover, we go on to think that when they function properly, when they're not subject to dysfunction, when there isn't madness, insanity, or cognitive glitches and so on, when they function properly in accord with our design plan, which would be a kind of set of specifications as to how our faculties work when they work properly, then for the most part they do precisely that. They do provide us with true beliefs. Of course, it's true that if you ask the witnesses to an accident what happened, you're likely to get several different stories. But there will be a underlying agreement. They'll agree, let's say, that it was in fact an automobile accident and not a volcanic eruption or a naval disaster or something like that. There will be agreement on the rough number of automobiles involved. It won't be that one person says it was a one-car accident, somebody fell asleep and ran off the road, and somebody else says, no, it was one of those 95-car Los Angeles freeway crashes. And there will be rough agreement on the location of the accident. It won't be that somebody says it happened in, say, Glasgow in Scotland, and somebody else says, no, it was Glasgow, Montana. And that there, this will be against the backdrop of even deeper agreement. There'll be agreement that people own automobiles rather than, say, vice versa. People use automobiles to accomplish their ends, to go places. That automobiles, if dropped out of helicopters, typically fall down. That they won't work on the surface of the moon or on the floor of the ocean. So there'll be a whole lot of basic agreement, even though there might be some disagreement about the details of the accident. We think that our faculties are much better adapted to reach the truth in some areas than in others. We think we're pretty good at elementary arithmetic, elementary logic, at the perception of middle-sized objects under ordinary conditions, remembering certain sorts of things. I'm very confident that I remember, or at least I don't remember, that there was say that the motel I slept in last night burnt down. I remember that that didn't happen. But things get more difficult. I mean, there's a whole gradation of confidence here. I don't remember nearly so confidently something I do, in fact, remember, but not as confidently, namely that when I was 14 years old, I had a red bicycle with balloon tires. That's still something I remember, but I don't remember that nearly as confidently. Things get more difficult when it comes to an accurate reconstruction of what it was like, say, to be a 5th century BC Greek. We might think we don't really have a very good idea about that. We're not so good at trying to figure that out, let alone what it's like to be a bat. This famous article of Tom Nagel's, many of you probably read, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? All right? And when we're working at the very limits of our powers, as in contemporary cosmology, for instance, when people try to figure out what happened during the first 1 over 10 to the 33rd second, which is not very long, when people try to figure out what happened during that period of time, then we're working at the very limits of our powers, and we're probably not going to be too successful there. We'll probably change our mind a lot, just as does happen, in fact, at the limits of science. Still, overall, and for the wide area of our cognitive functioning, we think that when our faculties function properly, they provide us with the truth, with true beliefs. Okay, but isn't there a problem here for the naturalist, at any rate for the naturalist, who thinks that we and our cognitive faculties arrived upon the scene after some billions of years of evolution by way of the kind of processes that people point to, natural selection or genetic drift or other blind processes, working on sources of genetic mutation, genetic variation, such as, for example, random genetic mutation? Isn't there a problem here? That's what I'm going to argue that there is. Richard Dawkins thinks there isn't. Richard Dawkins, according to Peter Medawar, one of the most brilliant of the rising generation of biologists, Richard Dawkins is a contemporary Oxford biologist. Peter Medawar was a very eminent biologist of the last generation. Richard Dawkins once leaned over and remarked to A.J. Ayer at one of those elegant, candlelit, bibulous Oxford College dinners. And if you haven't seen an Oxford College dinner, then you haven't seen elegant, candlelit, and bibulous. Leaned over and he said to him this. He said he couldn't imagine being an atheist before 1859. Which was the year Darwin's Origin of Species was published. Because, he said, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, wasn't self-contradictory, said he, Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. This is what Dawkins says in this book of his, The Blind Watchmaker. Those of you that have read much of A.J. Ayer or know much about him wouldn't be surprised to learn that A.J. Ayer just poo-pooed the suggestion by Dawkins and said he couldn't see why Darwin's work made any difference here to being an atheist at all, one way or the other. But this is what Dawkins thought. And next there is a little quotation here from Dawkins. I won't read that quotation from Dawkins. It's very interesting, but I won't take the time to read it. But now my point here is this. Dawkins thinks Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. But maybe Dawkins is dead wrong here. Maybe the truth lies in the opposite direction, i.e. that evolution poses a problem for naturalism rather than making it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled naturalist. Perhaps the truth lies in the opposite direction. If evolution is correct, if evolution conjoined with naturalism is correct, then the ultimate purpose, if they have an ultimate purpose, of our cognitive faculties, as of any of our faculties, will be survival, or perhaps survival together with procreation. It'll be the maximization, promotion of fitness, all right? They don't have as their purpose, then, the production of true beliefs. At least they don't have that as their ultimate purpose. If they did have that as a purpose at all, it would be a purpose in the service of another purpose. For example, Patricia Churchland points this out in this next little quotation. Boiled down to essentials, she says, a nervous system enables the organism to succeed in the four F's, feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing. The principle, I'm just reporting what she says, not taking any responsibility for it. I'm, you might say, mentioning these words, not using them. The principal chore of nervous systems, she says, is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. That's their purpose or chore. The purpose or chore of the nervous system. Improvements in sensory motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of representing is advantageous, so long as it is geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. A style of representing, you might think of that as cognition. So fancier cognition is advantageous so long as it's geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances of survival. That's what it's there for, so to speak. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost, she says. So what she's saying, it seems to me, is something like this. What the fact that we have evolved and survived, what that guarantees, if it guarantees anything at all, is that our behavior, or at least the behavior of our ancestors, has been reasonably adaptive to the circumstances that we or they find or found our or themselves in. All right? Now, that didn't come out very well. But the point is, what evolution guarantees, if it guarantees anything, is that behavior has been adaptive. It doesn't guarantee that beliefs have been true. That's a different question altogether. So that's what Patricia Churchland says on the one hand. On the other hand, we have W.V. O'Quine and Karl Popper. Popper says, since we have evolved and survived, we may be pretty sure that our hypotheses and guesses as to what the world is like are mostly correct. Because we've evolved and survived, we can be quite sure that our guesses, our hypotheses have been mainly right. And Quine says he finds encouragement in Darwin. Here's a quotation from Quine containing one of Quine's most famous lines. Quine has lots of famous lines. This is one of the famousest. He says, there is some encouragement in Darwin. If people's innate spacing of qualities, we can think of that just as if people's ways of thinking, if people's innate spacing of qualities is a gene-linked trait, if that goes along with, if that's genetically determined, you might say, then the spacing that is made for the most successful inductions, then the ways of thinking that have made for the most successful inductions, will have tended to predominate through natural selection. Creatures inveterately wrong in their inductions, and this is his famous line, have a pathetic but praiseworthy tendency to die before reproducing their kind. Okay, so he says, so Quine finds encouragement in Darwin, and in fact, Quine finds much more encouragement in Darwin than Darwin does. Here's a quotation from Darwin. With me, says Darwin, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind if there are any convictions in such a mind? So Quine says he finds encouragement in Darwin, encouragement with respect to this question. Are our cognitive faculties, in fact, reliable? Do they, for the most part, deliver true beliefs? All right. Quine says he finds encouragement in Darwin, but Darwin doesn't find encouragement in Darwin. He says he's got this horrid doubt. So then we have Quine and Popper on the one side, and Darwin and Churchland on the other side. Who is right? But maybe we can first sharpen the question. Exactly what is this argument about? Darwin and Churchland seem to believe that naturalistic evolution gives one a reason to doubt that human cognitive faculties are reliable or produce mostly true beliefs. To be reliable, they'd have to produce vastly more true beliefs than false. Call this Darwin's doubt. Quine and Popper, on the other hand, apparently hold that evolution gives us reason to believe that human cognitive faculties do produce, for the most part, true or verisimilitudinous, nearly true beliefs. How should we understand this dispute? Okay. Well, maybe we should understand it like this. Maybe what we have to think about is probability, and in particular, conditional probability, the probability of one proposition or state of affairs on the condition of something else, the probability that Mr. X is a Mormon given that, or on the condition that he lives in Aberdeen, Scotland, the probability that Mr. Y will will live to age 70, given that, or on the condition that he is a 30-year-old American male who smokes heavily, never gets any exercise, and is 100 pounds overweight. That would be sort of a low probability. Or the probability that Mr. X will live to be 70, given that he's, a 60-year-old American male who runs 5 miles every day, is skinny as a rail, and both of whose parents live to be 100. That would be quite a different probability, no doubt a much higher one. All right? So that's conditional probability. And I'm thinking here of objective probability, not the kind of probability that Bayesians talk about or that personalists in probability theory talk about, which is really a matter of degree of belief. I'm not thinking about that. I'm thinking about objective probability, which would be the kind involved in the two examples I just gave. So maybe that's what they're thinking about. One possibility, then, maybe Darwin and Churchland mean to propose that a certain conditional probability is low, the probability of human cognitive faculties being reliable, given that human cognitive faculties have been produced by evolution, Dawkins' blind evolution, unguided by the hand of God or any other person. If naturalistic evolution is true, then our cognitive faculties will have resulted from blind mechanisms like natural selection, working on sources of genetic variation such as random genetic mutation. And random genetic mutation is usually thought of as a matter of chance mutation. And the ultimate purpose or function, Churchland's chore, of our cognitive faculties, if indeed they have a purpose or function, will be survival of individual, species, gene, or genotype. But then it's unlikely that they have the production of true beliefs as a function. So the probability of our faculties being reliable, given naturalistic evolution, would be fairly low. Popper and Klein, on the other hand, judge that probability fairly high. All right? Now we can write probabilities, conditional probabilities, as many of you know, like this. P of A, one proposition or state of affairs, given that, or on the condition B, some other proposition or state of affairs. The probability that Jones is a Mormon, given that he lives, that Jones lives, say, in Aberdeen, Scotland, that'll equal some number between one, between zero and one. In this case, maybe it would be something, I don't know, something less than, well, undoubtedly less than a half. All right? So we can write probabilities like this, P of A on B, and then we say that probability is either high or low or equals some real number between 0 and 1. And so here I've written P of R on N and E on the sheet, where N is metaphysical naturalism, crucial to which, of course, is the view that there's no such person as the God of traditional theism, where E is the proposition that human cognitive faculties have arisen by way of evolution, as conceived by contemporary evolutionary science, and where R is the claim that our cognitive faculties are reliable. And so the question is then, what's the probability of R given N and E? That's our question. What's the probability of R on the condition that naturalism and evolution are both true? Darwin and Churchland propose that this probability is rather low. Quine and Popper think it fairly high. All right? Okay. In the next section, then, I want to develop the doubt developed. And then in the section after that, I want to develop the doubt again. So there will be two separate developments of Darwin's doubt. Okay, so suppose we think first not about ourselves and our ancestors, but about a hypothetical population of creatures rather like ourselves on a planet similar to Earth. Darwin proposed that we think about another species, such as monkeys. Suppose these creatures have cognitive faculties, hold beliefs, change beliefs, make inferences, and so on, just as we do. And suppose these creatures have arisen by way of the selection processes endorsed by contemporary evolutionary theory. What is the probability that their faculties are reliable? This is a kind of thought experiment, then. What is P of R on N and E specified now, not to us, but to them, to this hypothetical group of creatures living on some hypothetical planet revolving about a hypothetical sun? According to Quine and Popper, the probability would be rather high. Belief is connected with action, in such a way that extensive false belief would lead to maladaptive behavior, in which case it's likely that the ancestors of those creatures would have displayed that pathetic but praiseworthy tendency Quine mentions. All right. Okay, but I'm going to argue on the other side. I'm going to argue that that probability is low. So once again, first, maybe it's likely that their behavior is or was adaptive to their circumstances, but nothing so far follows about their beliefs. Evolution isn't directly interested in belief. It's interested in the right kind of behavior, the kind of behavior that promotes survival and reproduction. Everything depends upon the way in which their behavior is related to their beliefs for this question of the probability of R on N and E. That's what everything depends on. The question is whether evolution could shape their beliefs into a reliable form, or make their beliefs reliable, or shape their cognitive faculties in such a way that they become, that they are reliable by virtue of shaping their behavior. That's the question. So clearly, that depends on how their behavior and their beliefs are connected. All right? But next, I list four possibilities as to how they're connected and try to guess at the probability of R on each of those four, really on the conjunction of each of those four in turn with N and E. All right? And then I want to argue that in each of these four cases, the probability is rather low. And these four cases are mutually exclusive and together exhaustive. So if that's right, then it would follow that the probability of R on N and E simpliciter is low. All right? That's my strategy here. Okay, so the first suggestion as to how they might be related is epiphenomenalism. This is this was first suggested, so far as I know, by T.H. Huxley, who used to be called Darwin's bulldog. Apparently, Darwin didn't much enjoy public confrontations and arguments. But by the nature of what he said, he was always getting involved in confrontations and arguments. And T.H. Huxley did enjoy that. He agreed with Darwin on these things, but he did enjoy that. So Darwin would always just send T.H. Huxley out to get involved in these debates. He'd say, "Sick 'em, Huxley," and that's how come he got the name Darwin's Bulldog. All right. Well, one suggestion here is epiphenomenalism, according to which, and here's the sort of core of epiphenomenalism, according to which beliefs do not cause behavior. Beliefs are an epiphenomenon, as Huxley said. They're sort of like the whistle on a locomotive. The whistle on the locomotive doesn't cause the locomotive to behave in any particular way. It's rather produced by the way the locomotive behaves, but it doesn't, in its turn, exert any causal influence on the behavior of the locomotive. And epiphenomenalism holds that the same thing goes for our beliefs. They're there, all right, but they don't have causal efficacy. If that's true, then beliefs would be invisible to evolution, because evolution could only, so to speak, see behavior. And if beliefs aren't causally connected with behavior, evolution wouldn't have any effect on them. And then the fact that our beliefs arose during the evolutionary history of these beings would confer no probability at all on the idea that their beliefs are mostly true, or mostly nearly true, rather than being wildly false. Indeed, the probability of their being mostly true would have to be estimated as fairly low. The probability that a randomly chosen large set of propositions contains the vastly more true beliefs than false beliefs that reliability requires, that probability is low. It could be that one of these creatures believes that he is at that elegant, bibulous Oxford College dinner, when in fact he is slogging his way through some primeval swamp, desperately fighting off hungry crocodiles. So epiphenomenalism then is the view that beliefs do not cause behavior, have no causal efficacy with respect to behavior. And this view has been popular with lots of people sort of seriously interested in science, especially biological sciences, for a long time. For example, here's something from biologist J.M. Smith, a well-known biologist who about whom Time magazine ran an article about science a while back, about 3 years ago. And in this article, they wrote about this man, J.M. Smith, that a few years ago, he, J.M. Smith, wrote that he had never understood why organisms have feelings. After all, he says, orthodox biologists believe that behavior, however complex, is governed entirely by biochemistry, and that the attendant sensations, fear, pain, wonder, love, and he could have added belief, are just shadows cast by that biochemistry, not themselves vital to the organism's behavior. All right? Well, from the point of view of naturalism, materialism about human beings is extremely plausible. And from the point of view of materialism, well, forget that for the moment. From the point of view, just think about a human being, a human body, as a kind of complex machine, all right? Then the idea that somebody like J.M. Smith has is something like this. What causes behavior will be neural impulses of one kind or another. Signals will come from the brain, perhaps, and will travel down various nerves, cause contractions of muscles, and that's how behavior comes to be. And other signals will come from sense organs of various kinds, and will go to the brain where they'll be processed in a certain way, and then these signals going out from the brain will cause behavior of a certain sort. But there doesn't look like there's room for belief in there anywhere, for belief, so to speak, to get its hand in. There are just these neurological events. So on this first possibility then, the first of the four possibilities, the probability that their beliefs are mainly true and that their faculties are reliable will be low. The second possibility is that their beliefs do cause their behavior, but only by virtue of their electrochemical properties, not by virtue of their content. Let me explain what I mean there. Suppose you think of human beings as material objects, then, and you also think that they do in fact have beliefs. Well, then what will a belief be? What are the possibilities for a belief? What kind of a thing will it be? It'll have to be something like perhaps a long-standing neural event, a long-standing neural event of some kind, all right? And such a long-standing neural event, such a belief, will have to have two kinds of properties. On the one hand, it'll have electrochemical properties or neurological properties or biochemical properties, properties like the number of neurons involved in this long-standing event, how they're connected with each other, how many feed into a given one, let's say, how their firing changes with various other kinds of changes and the like of that. Electrochemical properties or biochemical properties, we could say. All right, that's one kind of property. But if this neural event really is a belief, it'll have another very different kind of property too. It'll have the property of being related to a certain proposition as the belief that P, where P is that proposition. So a given neurological event, you know, I don't know how to represent a thing like that. Lots and lots of neurons connected with each other in ways with connections going out and so on, have two kinds of properties. On the one hand, it'll have the semantic property of being the belief that P, maybe the belief that there used to be a brewery where the London Philharmonic building now stands, or where the Metropolitan Opera building now stands. There used to be a brewery there, all right? So it's got a connection with some proposition P, which is its content. It's the belief that P. Every belief has got to be the belief that something or other, right? That's got that kind of property on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's got these neurological properties or biochemical properties. Sometimes people call the first kind of property semantic, a semantic property, and the second syntactic, by analogy with syntax and semantics in language. All right. And now the second possibility among the four is that beliefs do indeed cause behavior, are causally efficacious with respect to behavior, but by virtue only of their syntactic properties and not by virtue of their semantic properties. All right? By virtue of their syntactic properties, by virtue of their properties having to do with what other nerves they cause to fire and how they're connected neurologically with the various muscles that actually produce behavior. All right? That's a second possibility. And from a materialist point of view, it's really hard to avoid this possibility. It's hard to see a real alternative to it. I mean, What does the causing of behavior will obviously be this, the syntactic properties, the biological, biochemical properties of this set of neurons, this neural event. The fact that it's connected somehow with this proposition P, in the first case, first place, it's hard to see how it could be connected with some proposition P. How does it get pointed at this booming, buzzing confusion of neurons clicking away? How does it somehow be the belief that P as opposed to some other proposition Q? And suppose it weren't pointed at P, but at some other proposition Q. Well, as long as it had the same syntactic properties, it would have the same causal properties with respect to behavior. So that the syntactic properties, that is the content of the belief, don't get into the loop at all as far as what gets caused is concerned, what behavior gets caused is concerned. All right? And that one, that possibility has the same results as the first possibility, namely evolution wouldn't be able to, so to speak, see content at all. It wouldn't be able to see the semantic properties of beliefs at all, but only the syntactic ones. It could only shape the syntactic properties of belief, but not the semantic ones. In which case, again, the probability that their beliefs are, for the most part, true, since truth, of course, is a property of the proposition, it's a semantic property, not a syntactic one, that will be relatively low. Okay, this possibility is said to be the received opinion by Robert Cummings in his book Meaning and Mental Representation. And as I say, from a sort of materialist, naturalist perspective, it's hard to see an alternative to it. Okay, a third possibility, it could be that beliefs cause behavior by way of content as well as syntax, but belief is maladaptive. It doesn't help the organism to survive, but kind of goes against its survival. Well, in this possibility, too, the probability that their beliefs are mainly true will be low. And finally, the last possibility, the beliefs of our hypothetical creatures cause their behavior and are also adaptive. This is the possibility that we think holds in our own case. And then what's the probability on this possibility, together with N and E, that their cognitive faculties are reliable? Well, not as high as you might think. Beliefs don't causally produce behavior just by themselves, just the beliefs by themselves. It's beliefs, desires, and other factors that do so together. So the problem, though, is that there clearly are any number of different patterns of belief and desire that will issue in the same action. And among those different patterns, there will be many in which the beliefs are wildly false. For example, Paul is a prehistoric hominid, and I apologize in advance to anybody named Paul here. I don't have you in mind. The exigencies of survival call for him to display tiger avoidance behavior. There's a tiger after him. Well, there'll be many behaviors that are appropriate. Fleeing, for example, or climbing a steep rock face, assuming tigers can't climb, say at least they can't climb overhangs very well, or crawling into a hole too small to admit the tiger, this is a large tiger, or leaping into a handy lake. When I wrote this, I thought that tigers, like cats, don't like water, but I gather that's false. They don't mind water a bit. So that would not be a very good way to escape the tiger. Okay, pick any such appropriately specific behavior. Call it B, like fleeing. Paul engages in B, we think, because, sensible fellow that he is, he has an aversion to being eaten, and he believes that B is a good way, that behavior, a good means of thwarting the tiger's intentions to eat him. But now, clearly, this avoidance behavior on the part of Paul could result from many other belief-desire combinations. There are indefinitely many other belief-desire systems that fit B or would produce B equally well. For example, perhaps Paul very much likes the idea of being eaten, but when he sees a tiger, he always runs off looking for a better prospect because he thinks it's unlikely that the tiger he sees will eat him. This will get his body parts in the right place so far as survival is concerned. He'll always run away when a tiger approaches without involving much by way of true belief. Or perhaps he thinks the tiger is a large, friendly, cuddly pussycat and wants to pet it. But he also believes, falsely, that the best way to pet it is to run away from it. Or maybe he confuses running towards it with running away from it. Or maybe he thinks the tiger is a regularly reoccurring illusion, and hoping to keep his weight down, has formed the resolution to run a mile at top speed whenever presented with such an illusion. Or perhaps he thinks he's about to take part in a 1600-meter race he wants to win, and he believes the appearance of the tiger is the starting signal. Or perhaps dot, 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 dot. And the point of the dot, 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 dot is to indicate that there are, you can think up as many of these possible hypotheses as you like, of combinations of belief and desire that together yield his running away where the beliefs are false. All right? So clearly there are any number of belief cum desire systems that equally fit a given bit of behavior. And in very, very many of those, the beliefs will be false. So in this case too, as in the other, since there are so many where combinations of belief and desire where the beliefs are false that yield this given bit of behavior, where the behavior is what evolution encourages or that evolution can see, in this case too, the probability of R will be relatively low. Trying to combine these probabilities overall then, for the four cases, in an appropriate way, it would be reasonable to suppose that the probability of R, of these creatures' cognitive systems being reliable, is relatively low, somewhat less than a half. Now return to Darwin's doubt. The reasoning that applies to these hypothetical creatures, of course, also applies to us. So if we think the probability of R with respect to them is low on N and E, we should think the same thing about the probability of R with respect to us on N and E. Something like this reasoning, I think, is what underlay Darwin's doubt. So we should think the probability that P of R on N and E for us, we should think that probability is low. And if we accept N and E, if we also do accept N and E, that gives us a defeater for our belief in R, a reason to doubt R, a reason to be agnostic about R, a reason not to believe it. If R is unlikely or improbable, given the way our faculties have actually come to be, then we have a reason to reject or withhold R. Up the doubt again in a different way. Well, you might notice that the argument I gave for a low estimate of P of R on N and E is a relatively weak argument. It's very vague in one way. I mean, all you can say about these probabilities is they're fairly low or fairly high. Certainly can't say anything very definite about them. So, and furthermore, not only that, but these guesses as to what the probabilities would be would have to be quite shaky. So maybe the right course here about these probabilities is just simple agnosticism. You just don't know what the probability is. You might say the probability is inscrutable. Can't tell what it is. Just too hard to tell what it is. And this also seems sensible. Well, what would then be the appropriate attitude towards R specified to that hypothetical population? Suppose someone who accepts N and E and also suppose someone who accepts N and E and also believes that the proper attitude towards P of R on N and E is one of agnosticism, someone like that, clearly has a good reason for being agnostic about R as well. So if you think this probability, you just can't tell what it is, it could be really high, it could be really low, then you've also got a reason for being agnostic with respect to R. All right? So that way, too, you get a defeater. But now suppose we again apply the same sort of reasoning to ourselves in our condition. Suppose we think N and E is true. We ourselves have evolved according to the mechanisms suggested by contemporary evolutionary theory, unguided and unorchestrated by God or anyone else. Suppose we think, furthermore, that there just is no way to determine P of R on N and E specified to us. What would be the right attitude to take to R? Well, if we have no further information, then wouldn't the right attitude here, just as with respect to that hypothetical population, be agnosticism, withholding belief? If this probability is inscrutable, then we have a defeater for R, just as in the case where the probability is low. All right? So my thesis then so far is this. P of R on N and E is either low or inscrutable, one or the other. In either case, if we accept N and E, we have a defeater for R. That's my thesis. All right. Okay, now next I want to argue for this thesis, which seems to me, maybe you think it's pretty clear without any argument for it, by way of some analogies, by way of three analogies. First analogy. Suppose I believe in God, and I come to believe that belief in God is produced by wish fulfillment, maybe belief generally, religious belief generally, but anyway, this one in particular. Maybe I unwisely read too much Freud, who says that people believe in God because it's really just too hard to face the harsh realities of this cold, cruel world, which pays no attention to us, is totally uncognizant of us, doesn't care a whit what happens to us. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you'll just get smashed without so much as an excuse me or a buy or leave or some kind of apology. Well, once you see the world in that fashion, says Freud, if you looked it full in the face and saw that that's the way things really are, which is the way they really are, he thinks, you would find this overwhelming. It would be really hard to take, and you might sink into depression and apathy and finally maybe just die, all right? So he says what people do is invent this Father in heaven who, they say, is really running things. Even though the world looks like it doesn't care a toot about us, that appearance is deceiving. God is behind all of this and is running things according to his own good purpose. Well, suppose I come to believe that. I believe that. So it comes by way. I believe that it's by way of wish fulfillment that my belief in God has been produced. And then suppose I consider the objective probability that a belief produced by wish fulfillment will be true. All right? Now, I'll think that as either low or else inscrutable. All my argument needs is this. Suppose I do think that it's either low, I think the probability that a belief produced by wish fulfillment it should be true is low, or else I think that probability is inscrutable. I say I don't know what it is. In either case, I have a defeater for any belief I take to be produced by wish fulfillment, including then my belief in God. I've got a reason to reject it, a reason not to hold it, a reason to be at least agnostic about it, a reason to withhold it. Okay. And if I can't find further evidence, then the rational thing to do is to reject it. Second kind of case, imagine you're in a factory where you're confronted with an assembly line, and there are lots of widgets. I have no idea what a widget is, but let's say they're squarish objects about 5 by 10 in size, rectangular objects, all right? And they look red. You see them, they look red. So you think they are red. Well, then along comes the shop superintendent, and he tells you that they are being irradiated by red light for quality control reasons. That way you can tell if there are hairline cracks in them, all right? Well, then you've got a defeater for your belief that they are red, that a given one of them is red, because even if it weren't red, it would still look red. Okay, suppose it were white. If it's irradiated by red light, it'll still look red. And a reason then for rejecting that belief that it is in fact red. Second kind of case, suppose as in the first case, that's what the shop superintendent tells you. I mean, in the second kind of case, you think that the probability that a given widget is red, given that it looks red, you'll think that probability is fairly low. But second, here's the second kind of case where you'll be agnostic about it and still have a defeater. Just as in the first case, the shop superintendent tells you that they're being irradiated by red light. But then along comes a vice president of the company, and he tells you that this shop superintendent just has a thing about widgets and red light. He always tells everybody that they're irradiated by red light, whether or not they really are. But then you take a look at this vice president, and you simply don't think he looks reliable. He's kind of got a shifty look, and he kind of looks this way and that way. Got a kind of shifty look to his eyes. So you don't really know whether this guy is telling the truth or not. All right? Well, then you're going to have to be agnostic about the probability that a given widget is red, given that it looks red. You don't know who to believe, the shop superintendent or the vice president. You haven't the faintest idea which of these guys, if either, is telling you the truth. Maybe they're both just full of baloney. Well, in that case, the probability of a given widget's being red, given that it looks red, will be inscrutable for you. But you'll have a defeater for it. You will give up, presumably, if you're reasonable, give up your initial belief that the widget in question is red. All right? Third kind of case, suppose you come to think you've been created by Descartes' malignant demon. You remember early on in Descartes' meditations, he says, he's wondering what he can doubt. And he says he can doubt that he's sitting in front of the fire. He can even doubt that he's got a body. Well, what about mathematical truths? Can he doubt that 2 times 4 is 8? Well, he says, I could have been created by a malignant demon who takes delight in creating creatures and giving them false beliefs. You know, and if I were, then I might believe that 2 times 4 is 8 when the fact is it isn't. It's 91 or whatever. All right? So suppose you are Descartes and you come to think, you think about this fantasy of his so long, and it appeals to you so much you finally think that you yourself were created by a Cartesian malignant demon who takes pleasure in deceiving those creatures he creates. Most of the beliefs held by his creatures are false. Well, then again, you've got a defeater for any belief you hold. The probability that a given belief of yours, a belief is true, given that you hold it, will be low, and that will give you a defeater for any belief you do in fact hold. And the same will go even if you think not that in fact you've been created by such a Cartesian deceptive demon, but if you think the probability that you've been is inscrutable. If you think, well, for all I know, that probability could be really high, or it could be really low. All right. Okay, now suppose we return to the person convinced of NNE who is agnostic about this probability. Something similar goes for him. He is in the same position with respect to any belief B of his as is the above believer in God. He is in the same condition with respect to B as is the widget observer who didn't know who or what to believe about those red lights. He is in the same condition as the person who comes to think she's been created by that Cartesian evil demon. So he too has a defeater for B and a good reason for being agnostic with respect to it. Okay, but now we're finally ready for the bottom line, the argument itself, the argument an sich. Okay, section 3. Now for the argument that it's irrational to believe NNE. Here's the argument. P of R on NNE is either low or inscrutable. In either case, if you accept NNE, you have a defeater for R. But if you have a defeater for R, then you've got a defeater for any other belief B you might hold, any belief that is produced by your cognitive faculties. But B can be NNE itself. That's one of the beliefs you've got. So, if you accept NNE, you've got a defeater for NNE, a reason to doubt it or to be agnostic with respect to it. If this person who accepts NNE has no independent evidence, then the rational course for him will be to reject belief in NNE. If he has no independent evidence, NNE will be self-defeating that belief and hence irrational. He'll be irrational in holding it. Okay, well, could he maybe get a defeater for this defeater? Beliefs can be defeated by defeaters, but defeaters of beliefs can in turn be defeated by, we might say, defeater defeaters, right? And of course, you could have defeater defeater defeaters, and defeater defeater defeaters defeaters, and so on. After about 2 repetitions, it gets very hard to follow and very uninteresting, but in principle, you can go as far as you please, all right? So could he get a defeater for this defeater, a defeater defeater? Could he get one maybe by doing some science? He says, well, let's just try to figure out scientifically whether or not our beliefs are reliable, whether our cognitive faculties are reliable, and our beliefs are mainly true. Well, the answer is no, you can't do that. Because in accepting some such argument, for the reliability of your faculties. You are, of course, trusting your faculties in accepting the premises and in accepting your belief that the premises support the conclusion. In accepting those beliefs, you're already taking it for granted that the beliefs your cognitive faculties produce or emit are, in fact, true. As Thomas Reed says, Thomas Reed is an absolutely first-rate epistemologist. If a man's honesty were called into question, it would be ridiculous to refer to the man's own word, whether he be honest or not. So if you're worried about whether this man tells lies, says Reed, the right way to find out is not to ask him, right? The same absurdity there is in attempting to prove by any kind of reasoning, probable or demonstrative, that our reason is not fallacious, since the very pointed question is whether reasoning may be trusted. And that's a good point, I think. Well, is there any sensible way at all in which the person who accepts NNE can argue for R in the face of this defeater? I think not. Any argument he might produce will have premises, and these premises, he claims, give him good reason to believe R. But, of course, he's got the very same defeater for each of those premises that he had for R itself. So this defeater cannot be defeated. We can also put it like this. Any argument that he offers for R, the person who accepts NNE, is circular or delicately question-begging. Naturalistic evolution gives its adherents a reason for doubting that our beliefs are mostly true. Perhaps they are mostly mistaken. But then it won't help to argue that they can't be wildly mistaken. For the very reason for mistrusting our cognitive faculties generally will be a reason for mistrusting the faculties that produce belief in the goodness of the argument, in the truth of the premises, and the connection between premises and conclusion. So the devotee of NNE has a defeater for NNE, a defeater that can't be defeated. NNE, therefore, is self-defeating and can't rationally be accepted. One who contemplates accepting N and is torn, let's say who contemplates accepting NNE, and is torn, say, between N and theism, should reason as follows. If I were to accept NNE, I would have good and ultimately undefeated reason to be agnostic about N, so I shouldn't accept it. The traditional theist, on the other hand, has no corresponding reason for doubting that it is a purpose of our cognitive systems to produce true beliefs, nor any reason for thinking that the probability of a belief being true, given that it is a product of her cognitive faculties, is low or inscrutable. She may indeed endorse some form of evolution, but if she does, it will be a form of evolution guided and orchestrated by God. And, qua traditional theist, qua Jewish, Muslim, or Christian theist, she believes that God is the premier knower and has created us human beings in his image, an important part of which involves his giving them what is needed to have knowledge, just as he does. The conclusion to be drawn, therefore, is that the conjunction of naturalism with evolutionary theory is self-defeating. It provides for itself an undefeated defeater. It is therefore unacceptable and irrational. Thank you.